There is so much misunderstanding of the proper role of civil rights agencies, but I think it is important to discuss it in this forum today. Some weeks back, I was a guest on William Buckley's Firing Line, and the one theme he kept coming back to and later devoted several columns to was this: why do civil rights leaders concentrate on national economic policy, urban policies, and other issues when their proper role is to stick to civil rights? I thought this was a theme peculiar to the specific ideological viewpoint Buckley and other conservatives cling to. By the way, this new concern for civil rights is heartening. Back in the 60s, the same people were upset because civil rights seemed to infringe on property rights, to which they give higher priority. Since most black leaders favor expanded government efforts and increased domestic spending, I could see where there would now be a reluctance to see greater black involvement in issues perceived as general economic ones. But since then, I have come across liberals who make the same point. They've told me that blacks, as blacks, shouldn't be taking public positions on energy, tax cuts, unemployment, and other key issues. We should be concentrating on the moral aspects of securing full civil rights for minorities and leave the other issues to experts more qualified to deal with them, they say. Two Sundays ago, the New York Times made that point in effect when it said, and I quote, "Increasingly, black leaders have taken up economic issues and other matters whose relationship to the welfare of minorities, while real, is not as direct or as clear-cut as before. In so doing, those leaders have raised difficult questions about whom they represent, who their allies are, and whether the moral banner they once held so high still carries the same inspiration." Today, I hope to answer some of those difficult questions. Frankly, I find it difficult to understand why sophisticated analysts, people presumably familiar with the realities of American life, should have doubts about the changed direction of the civil rights movement. It would seem self-evident that changing conditions demand changed strategies and tactics. In the 1950s and 60s, the basic thrust of blacks and other minorities was to achieve the equality under the law that had been denied them. Eating at the lunch counter, the right to sit anywhere on the bus, the right to drink water rather than colored water, the right to vote or to check into a hotel are all easily understandable. The denial of those simple rights was an affront to human rights and to the democratic system. The issues then were clear-cut. The actors in the civil rights drama were clearly identified: the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys marched peacefully, were nonviolent, suffered death, violence, jail, and other indignities. The bad guys looked mean and acted mean. They used cattle prods, water hoses, and dogs on women and children. The bad guys promised never, no, not one, massive resistance and segregation today, tomorrow, and forever. Behind the discussion about what the real nature of today's civil rights movement should be is a lingering nostalgia for those good old days of clear-cut moral decisions and easily defined issues. But that phase of the movement is over. The basic rights were won through judicial decisions, legislation, and executive orders. But the reality behind those rights has not kept pace. Black people today can check into any hotel in America, but most do not have the wherewithal to check out. It is too often forgotten that the 1963 March on Washington was for more than just abstract rights. It was for jobs and freedom. To a large extent, we won the freedoms, but we still do not have the jobs. There are today 500,000 more black people unemployed than at the time of the March on Washington in 1963. So economics was always a part of the civil rights movement concerns. So too were housing, urban policies, health, and a whole range of issues that affected blacks disproportionately because we were and are disproportionately poor, in bad housing, in bad health, and in deteriorating urban centers. But are those properly civil rights issues? Yes, they are, because the disproportionate disadvantage born by blacks and other minorities is the heritage of centuries of oppression. It is the residue of a society that practiced institutional discrimination and racism. It is the result of a complex web of federal, local, and private sector practices that operated to the exclusion of blacks and their interests. The rights granted in the 1960s left that structure largely intact. The National Urban League's report, The State of Black America, 1978, documents the fact that black progress has been limited. In the report's words, there is a disturbing duality of the black economy, a slowly growing black middle class, and an increasingly jobless lower economic class. So despite some gains in employment and in education, the masses of black people did not witness significant changes in their lives in the 1960s. We were poor then, we are poor today. We were disadvantaged then, we remain so today. There is a moral dimension in this. We are saying to the American people, you cannot simply say you have your rights. We won't discriminate in an overt fashion anymore, and then just walk away from the problem. We are saying that there is a moral imperative to right the wrongs of the past. Black people were placed on a lower track and continue to struggle for survival on that same track. We are saying that the rights granted in the 60s are hollow, unless we are given the opportunity to compete on the same track as whites. The reluctance of our society to understand the simple point that black people want equality in real life and not just on the law books is mute testimony to the undercurrent of racism that still survives in America. So I would contend that there is a straight line that runs through the civil rights movement's history, a line of concern with improving the life chances of black people. Economics, urban policy and related issues were always at the forefront of our concerns. But the first line of attack had to be overtly discriminatory barriers. Once those barriers were lowered, we could then pursue our basic goal of achieving black equality in the realities of American life. And that is why civil rights leadership has in the 1970s become so concerned with jobs and urban policy, to mention just two basic areas. To some, it may seem as though we are now no different from any other group asking for an improved economy, for urban revitalization, or for similar goals, but we are different. We bring a specifically black viewpoint and experience to those issues, and we are concerned with bringing to the nation's attention the simple fact that generalized answers to national problems will perpetuate black disadvantage. Let me illustrate this. The unemployment rate is supposed to be trending downward. The overall official rates are now at 6.3% level. There is a widespread feeling that unemployment is coming under control and is no longer the pressing problem it was a while back when a tenth of the labor force was out of work. But from a black perspective, that's not true at all. The black unemployment rate is not only well over double the white rate, but it is slightly higher than it was a year ago. The white rate has improved, the black rate has continued to rise. And we don't even discuss here how the official statistics don't include many of the black unemployed at all. My point is that while white Americans are talking about how well the economic recovery is progressing, black people in America are still in an economic depression. Urban revitalization is another issue demanding a black perspective. Many people say the cities can be restored to economic health by attracting the middle class back. But what about the largely poor black urban population? Not a word. The implication is that they'll have to be moved out somewhere else. Some of the urban proposals I've heard remind me of the old urban renewal programs that became tagged black removal because blacks were bulldozed out of their homes to make way for luxury housing and for office centers. Let me quote that Times article again. It says the National Urban League denounced the president's plan for a $25 billion tax cut. At first glance, it might seem that a reduction would benefit minorities by expanding the economy. Well, first glances are very misleading. The National Urban League opposes the tax cut because it would not solve the problems of minorities. There is little evidence to conclude that the job stimulation effect of the tax cut would trickle down to minorities. We think the white unemployment rate would drop a little, but the high, astronomically high black rate would be largely unaffected. There are those who believe in John Kennedy's phrase that a rising tide lifts all boats, but we must remind them that a rising tide lifts only those boats in the water, and black people are in the dry dock of this economy. Rather than scatter $25 billion to the winds, we want that money or a large part of it used to create jobs directly, either in public service employment, in public works, or in creative incentives to private industry to hire and train the unemployed. A broad tax cut would not only defeat our goal of lowering black unemployment, but would create a large deficit that would, in itself, become the excuse for not undertaking urban programs the nation needs. But then there is something else in those tax proposals, something virtually no one has latched on to. The administration is proposing to extend the investment tax credit to new construction as well as to machinery. What that means is that the government, through the tax law, would offer incentives to industry to accelerate the abandonment of older cities. In effect, it is a subsidy to increase black unemployment. It is ironic that this proposal comes at a time when the administration is about to announce its national urban policy. Whatever positive measures that policy will include are likely to be offset by tax policies that drain more jobs from the cities. In the light of this, how can anyone claim that civil rights leaders ought to be tending to the business of fighting for abstract civil rights, when our constituents face economic policies that leave them destitute, without jobs, without the human dignity we preach to other nations? Civil rights don't take place in a vacuum. They are meaningful only in the real world, the world where people have to survive, to work, to raise their families, to instill in the skills to function in a society where a broad back and a desire to work are no longer enough. That is why we are concerned with tax cuts, with energy, with a multitude of issues some white people think are not the concern of blacks. That is why we see our present efforts as being the logical outcome of those struggles for basic rights of the 1960s. And that is why we insist there is a vital moral component to the current struggle. The Times story asks, whether the moral banner they once held so high still carries the same inspiration. And the unequivocal answer is, yes, it does. It does because the struggle for equality is identical with the struggle for jobs, for housing, for education, for urban vitality. When a third of the poor are drawn from the tenth of the population, that's a moral issue. When a third of the jobless are drawn from a tenth of the population, that's a moral issue. When public and private policies strangle the cities in which the majority of blacks live, that's a moral issue. When a nation that subjected its black people first to slavery and then to persistent oppression and now subjects them to disproportionate disadvantage, that's a moral issue. And it is a moral issue when people label limited affirmative action to help blacks overcome past and present discriminatory practices as reverse discrimination. Every statistic in any field shows continued white advantage. Where is this reverse discrimination? In an economy where blacks with some college have the same unemployment rates as white high school dropouts, where blacks with some high school education have double the unemployment rates of whites who never got past elementary school. It's a moral issue when welfare is labeled a black program while the majority of welfare recipients are white. It's a moral issue when every halting step of black progress is fought, when policies that would perpetuate a system that locks blacks into the bottom of our society are proposed. And it is that moral factor that continues to distinguish the civil rights movement. It is that moral factor that makes our views on tax policy different from those of clearly defined interest groups. And it is that moral factor so many people refuse to acknowledge today. Their refusal is based on the desire to avoid the necessary steps to modify the function of our society in a way that would help blacks and other minorities overcome their present disadvantage. Steps like a national full employment policy, a Marshall Plan for the cities, a national health plan, and others. And what we ask for ourselves, in a spirit of enlightened self-interest and in a spirit of desperate need, will also benefit the white poor. Everything we got in the 60s, everything we won through bitter struggles and moral suasion helped more white people than black people. So I'm here today to say that the moral banner is still unfurled. It still waves high above the current struggle. The issues are more complex and the resistance more entrenched. But the civil rights movement is still about the business of bringing America's minorities into the mainstream of our national life with all of the rewards and the responsibilities others take for granted. In the 1960s, we fought, bled, and died to build an open, pluralistic, integrated society. In the 1970s, that is still our goal. That is still our moral burden. Thank you very much.